The Reaction Podcast is back. Actually, we've decided just to go back to the format that we used to really like doing. It's almost as though there's been some kind of pandemic and things have been shaken up and we're going back to some kind of normality. All sorts of other things are available as YouTube videos. This will be a YouTube video as well, but it really is just the old Reaction Podcast format that we haven't really been running for a while. I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, my colleague from Reaction, and Alistair Benn from Reaction. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. There's tons to talk about, and I think we should probably kick off, shouldn't we, Maggie, with Russia and Ukraine, where, well, it's been a big week on that front with diplomatic efforts by the Brits, with Ben Wallace, the defense secretary there, and Liz Truss. And you wrote for the site, or we wrote on the site, about the backlash to her joint appearance with Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and what was wrong, or what was deemed to have gone wrong.
Well, what it was, they'd obviously had their talks and then they had a press conference afterwards. And Lavrov was rather rude to Truss and said that it was like talking to a deaf person. Truss was actually quite strong in hitting back against him. But what was very surprising and rather upsetting was the response given by a lot of the British media to her. They almost seemed to be preferring Lavrov's response than hers. And I think a lot of us felt that this was really rather mean about her. These were genuine efforts on the British part. Boris Johnson's already been to Kiev. Ben Wallace is in Moscow today, I believe. And it seemed rather, there's that sort of sense that why would you be wanting to support the Russian response in this rather than our own British Foreign Secretary, who is genuinely trying to calm things down. It was astonishing, actually.
Yeah, I was rather taken aback by it. Maybe it's a legacy of all the Brexit wars and the infighting, national infighting, just this assumption on the part of some people who shall remain nameless. Certainly not all. And this is not a Brexit Remain division necessarily, but there just does seem to be a strand of, I was going to call it elite opinion, but it's not that, because on Twitter it's pretty widespread among a certain kind of certain kind of what's the phrase, community or set of interest groups, and the view is just, well, it's Britain, it's the British Foreign Secretary, so obviously we are inherently crap at everything. So when Lavrov, this is Lavrov, this is the guy who last week said Russia is never attacked, Russia only responds defensively, which is the old Stalinist line, which was used to explain what the Russians, what the Soviets did in concert with the Germans in 1939, in concert with the Nazis in 1939, when they subdivided, or they divided in half Poland and killed the intellectuals and massacred the officer class on the Russian side and plundered the country. Now, so that's Lavrov, who's prepared to use those old 20th century Stalinist ways of speaking about history. That's who you're dealing with. It's someone ultra cynical, highly intelligent, a real manipulator on the foreign stage. And Truss was, I thought, was pretty, he tries to play a few tricks, but I thought she was pretty robust in delivering a message that has been the UK policy, which I think the Brits have actually handled it really pretty well, and thought she expressed that fairly clearly. Do you agree, Alistair, or disagree?
I thought at the press conference she was, as you said, she delivered the line that has been the line for, including Ben Wallace, including Boris Johnson, talking about the self-determination of Ukraine and saying that it's a core principle of the kind of Western alliance that shouldn't be violated, and she did that. I as a you know, in my own small way, as a kind of in the medium term, having been critical of Liz Truss, I don't think she's a very good foreign secretary. And she's done several things over the last 6 months, which are kind of alarming to me. There was a moment when she, in the aftermath of the AUKUS pact, was photographed like making a joke about how, you know, French champagne isn't great and we prefer Australian sparkling wine or something like that. I may have got that wrong. It was along those lines. And I just thought, you know, you're supposed to be Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom. Like, don't make cheap jokes about a strategic alliance which has really pissed off one of our closest partners and has really embarrassed them. And I just thought, you know, and the visit to Moscow, I don't see Ben Wallace posing for the cameras quite so much as Truss, you know, in the Russian style hats and walking around Red Square. I don't know. There has to be an element of, you know, kind of politicking there that, you know, I mean, all politicians are vain and politic, but I don't know. I felt she didn't exactly do herself any favours.
But do you not feel, though, that women in those situations are then held to a different standard, and there's a focus on the outfit? I mean, as you noted, Maggie, earlier in the week, it's cold. It's cold in Moscow, particularly at this time of year. And that's what you wear. I mean, that's what a hat for a woman looks like. What's she supposed to wear instead? Is she supposed to say, I better not be seen wearing something that looks a bit like the hat that Thatcher wore or lots of people wear in Russia when they're in Russia? I'll wear a baseball cap instead, or something, which means I won't be criticised by certain people in British media.
Having been to Russia and worn a T-shirt and trainers, I disagree. You don't need to dress it up.
But it wasn't in February.
I've been to Moscow in the winter, walked around the Kremlin at midnight in the snow and about minus 10 degrees. It is cold, I can tell you. And you wouldn't, you know, would you want her to wear a sort of anorak, duvet down type thing, you know? I mean, honestly,
why not? It's so fair. Why not a patriotic British hat, you know, one of the, you know, great,
like a gamekeeper
of a hod or a kind of muffled a gamekeeper's get up or something that gestures to our kind of rural inheritance and, you know, deep England, you know.
I think it was a nice standard hat. I don't think she meant anything by it. I don't think she was trying to mimic Thatcher or I know she's been criticised in the past for doing that. Do you think, though, Maggie, do you think Britain is, am I being too sanguine about this or too patriotic about it? I think the British position is broadly correct, which is different from the French position. The French position is, look, there's always something that can be negotiated here. The British position, without attempting to be too confrontational, is to say that there isn't a grubby compromise to be done, that this is a fairly fundamental question of self-determination for Ukraine, the Baltic states and Poland, who can, as Ben Wallace said the other evening, in his interview, that they should be able to make the alliances that they choose.
Yes, I do broadly agree with that principle, but you can also see maybe we should look at how the Russians feel about it, which is that they see that the eastern part of the NATO has expanded and is sitting all the way around its borders. And what they want to do is go back to the Minsk agreement, which I believe France is a signatory to, and they want some assurance that there won't be further expansion. So maybe there is some sort of room in between to compromise, certainly not what Macron was after, the sort of Finlandization of Ukraine. I mean, that basically means takeover, doesn't it? That was, I think.
And it gives Russia, it would give Russia all sorts of vetoes on Ukraine's freedom for manoeuvre. And also, what if you look at the ridiculous document, the demands issued by the Russians which is the cause of all of, essentially the cause of all of this, this thing they put on the table saying there is no negotiation, this is Russia's position, and then if anything short of full agreement is confrontational. And that really is what they're wanting to do, is to dictate who countries like Poland and Sweden can, and Finland can, cooperate with in terms of military defense, security, and intelligence. They are attempting to make those places spheres of Russian influence and divide the West. I mean, they're helped in all of this, of course, aren't they, by the West being, Alistair, pretty divided, because the German and French position, as we discussed earlier, the French position, but also in alliance with Germany, is to try and find some compromise and some way through. And then on the other side of Germany, the Poles, with a lot of experience of the consequences of being trapped between the Germans and the Russians historically, the Poles look to countries like Britain and look to NATO's leadership, really fearing the prospect of some sort of compromise.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, on the German position, I mean, it's, you know, there's a constituency in the kind of German debate which says, you know, I think you can understand why Germans find it very difficult, the idea of sending arms to fight Russians, because the total nightmare of the 20th century and the story of, you know, Germans in Russia. I mean, I'm reading Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate at the moment, which is about Stalingrad and about the kind of broad sweep of the Soviet experience in the Second World War. What I find interesting, again, I'm no expert on Russian history at all, really not at all, but there must be a kind of sort of set of emotions around Ukraine and Russia that I think probably make the British viewpoints sound tin-eared, because you look on in Grossman's Life and Fate, Ukrainians and Russians are indistinguishable people. They fight for the same side. They have the same likes and dislikes. They talk that there's so much travel between Ukraine and the rest of Russia. You know, in the officers in Stalingrad, some are Ukrainian, some are Russian. It seems to be like the least amount of division between kind of characters. Whereas it's noted that, for example, like Tatar characters very much do have a different view of their minority within the Soviet system in the book. And it just got me thinking, you know, when Ben Wallace writes, however eloquent, a piece about Putin's kind of essay on Ukrainian identity, or Liz Truss in a meeting with Lavrov gets wrong territories which are just part of Russia and says, you know, I think it's Voronezh, she in the meeting claims was disputed, and Rostov. I mean, it's just that, you know, offense flies two ways, I think, and I think there can be a little bit of a misreading of the Russian position, and the Brits have for a century been misreading the Russian mindset. We published a great essay on Engelsberg Ideas, the site we run, and about by Michael Goodman at King's College London, entitled Misreading the Russian Mindset, which is about the Joint Intelligence Committee over the last 70 years getting the Russian position slightly wrong. And it happens quite a lot. Yeah. And I don't know. I think there's an element of, I think we just have to have an element of humility at the moment about.
You mentioned.
Our allies like Poland are saying that Britain are lending support, and Zelensky is pleased that we're doing it. And I think that's really important, and I support that. But I just think the picture seems sort of unclear at the moment what precisely is the game.
You see, I disagree. So I disagree. But firstly, just a plug for, you mentioned Engelsberg Ideas, which is a fantastic site, which is produced by Alistair and members of the Reaction team. And it's this week, the next phase of its development. And it features a lot of the best sort of writers and thinkers and academics and historians and philosophers from around the world. And the next phase of its development has a new book section, which launched today and is available. We'll put a link below and send out a link to Reaction subscribers to make sure that you see it. And there's a fabulous review of Zubok's new book on the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is fabulous book, essentially a revisionist account blaming Gorbachev, and via really good deep dive in the archives and new material, rethinking how you should think about the end of the Soviet Union and the arrogance of the West in that period. Now, I get all of that. And I have to say, if you asked me the question maybe 10 years ago, I would have been of the mindset which said, look, we've long misread the Russians. We have to think about Russia differently. We have to understand that somewhere like Ukraine, okay, it's independent, but it's within, for the reasons you described, within a broad Russian sphere of influence. And Russia wants pride and respect from the West. And I have to say, my view shifted a lot, actually, in the last couple of years, partly just from reading more widely on it and talking to Russia heads and people who academics who spend a lot of time in this zone. And actually, I think Sikorsky, the former Polish defense minister, who's been incredibly robust on this, I think his analysis, which is done almost to the point of caricature, I think he's absolutely right. And I think he essentially says, look, do not, you have to be as robust as possible, particularly with this Russian regime, but you have to think, the only thing it respects is being really, really hard-nosed about potential conflict and not falling for the myth of Russia, which, and various academics have written about this, but it is an inherently, this is not directed at individual Russians, but it is a ludicrous notion, this myth of Mother Russia, this idea of Russia having a soul and being unique among all countries in terms of its kind of God-given status, and this endless sentimentality and romanticism about Russia, which, and it's, of course, it had the traumas of the 20th century, but large parts of that trauma were self-inflicted, self-inflicted by Russian regimes on Russians. And so I think Sikorsky's right. I think, and that's not the British government position, and his is a robust, Polish, it takes a sort of robust Polish view of the situation. But I think that to me is much more persuasive than as just falling for this myth of Russia. I mean, Maggie, you probably disagree with me.
Slightly. I think all countries have mythologies about themselves, don't they? A Russian politician I once spoke to said, what you have to understand, if you want to understand Russia, Maggie, stand in Moscow and look south, look at the borders. We feel that we are being encircled by the rest. And I think there is a sense of that. They don't have their own sea outlets, which is why Syria and so forth, these countries are so important to them. And Ukraine has been part of Russia for years. I mean, I believe I've been to Kiev and I've seen Bulgarov's house. There are a lot of, I believe Tchaikovsky may have been Ukrainian. Their cultures are so entwined.
Well, it depends on the right, on West and East. I mean, there's a division.
Yeah. So, but to get to the nuts of this, nuts and bolts, is Russia is terrified that Ukraine will join NATO. I mean, that is sort of really what got this started, isn't it? What I guess the diplomats have to decide is, Jens Stoltenberg has said, it's up to each country individually, who obviously won't force. The Ukraine has said it will not join, but it did want to join the EU. I think that maybe you can understand why Russia would not want Ukraine part of NATO.
Why though? Why? So let's just
because on then you've got on the borders, like my man saying, look at the country from standing from Moscow. Then you've got, if you like, the Western influence sitting on every border, and I think the Russians feel very insecure.
Well, they do. Well, they clearly do. But I'm just asking the fundamental question: what would be wrong with that? I can understand why that would. Doesn't fit with Vladimir Putin's conception of what Russia is. And someone put it to me the other day, he actually really, really, if you read that essay, he also wants Constantinople. Now that's, yeah. he's not going to
and Rome
invade,
as well.
But the Turkish economy is in a really difficult, difficult place, but he's at the moment. And then that standoff between that, weird relationship between Turkey and Russia. They've been enemies for a long time, but then they have understandings, and Turkey is reliant on Russian gas to an extraordinary extent. Turkey's got inflation of 36%, 80% unofficially. But Turkey's also a NATO member, a key NATO member, and supports Ukraine. So you've got all of that tension. I can understand that tension, but I don't actually think Ukraine would or will join NATO. But even if it did, what's the problem? What are they fearing? What do they have to fear from the Swedes, the Finns, the Poles, Ukrainians, who are all countries where the populations are overwhelmingly want peace and don't want to have a war or fight with anyone and want to get on with the business of prosperity and making their way in the world. It's not as though any of them are planning or secretly have some deep historical desire to invade exactly. Russia. Obviously the Germans have tried that and the French have tried it, but I mean the Poles, the Ukrainians and the Swedes and the Finns just don't want to be menaced by Moscow.
No, and I think that's the question that I would have for President Putin, whether it's Boris or Biden, whatever, say, why are you so scared? Do you actually think that NATO is going to invade you? What is it that has led you to this position? Sort of turn it round in a sense. He is saying that Western, having more troops in Romania and Poland is aggressive towards the Russians, but does he actually believe it? He's never expressed that, and I don't quite know what his answer would be, but he can't believe that. Anyway.
To explain that, Maggie, I think you have to sort of try and future plan how Fortress Russia, which is how it's developed, sees itself as a kind of tragic onlooker on world affairs, which is, as Ian, as you were saying, the kind of... sort of bullshit view, rooted in a lot of fake history, a lot of bad history. And that's the one that's become quite salient. But from their perspective, they look at the world and they see maybe in the next 20 or 30 years, the way migration will work from the global south, an inevitable and tragic consequence of changes in our climate, wars, instability. Russia will look at the seaways through to the Gulf and see places hedged with geopolitical threat. It looks to China. I know Russia and China are now supposed to be best buddies, but fundamentally, Russia will not cede control of the kind of Eurasian landmass to a Chinese kind of to the Chinese states. That's not just not going to happen in places like the Stans, places which are seen as part of Russia's sphere of influence. So it goes so far. So from their perspective, however paranoid and wrong-headed they are, they look on the world as a dangerous place which doesn't have Russia's interests at heart at all. And they're saying, well, we want what NATO has, in effect, a place to position, in times of threat, to position missiles and put troops and to do all that as well. I think, I don't know, is that's probably too charitable, but
That's interesting.
I think it's dreadful. It's, you know, they cannot do what they're going to, what potentially they might do in Ukraine without serious pushback from the West, and it has to be more than material. It has to be real political and material aid to Ukraine and sort of physical stuff, and that just has to happen. But I just think the mindset is one. I'm just not sure what we're doing by pointing out that the Russians are, you know, the Russians are sort of nasty and they just want to take back bits of Eastern Europe, because they, when they look at the world, they see a world with no guarantees, and they're trying to find some guarantees and to make their presence felt.
I'm certainly not saying that Russians are nasty, but plenty of nice and charming and interesting and intelligent Russians. Not the point, not the point I'm making, but just I would just think it's more fundamental than that. I just think leave these countries alone. It's like Poland wants to be Poland. Don't menace it. Don't tell, you know, don't present a sort of fake historical picture about what happened. We all know what happened in the late 1930s and early 1940s and then through the Cold War. So just let it exist and try and find a route to coexistence. But that requires some kind of historical honesty and, you know, requires plain dealing, and that's what troubles me about this situation. And it's not just Poland that's getting it. It's the Baltic states, which of course they still see as somehow having been stolen from them in the settlement and in the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. It's their strange attitudes to Finland and to contemporary Sweden, and then, you know, their attitude to Ukraine. I think we should we talked a lot there about Russia and Ukraine. You're listening to the Reaction podcast, which is back. We've decided actually just to go back to the old format where we talk about the things that have interested us in the news or culture or whatever grabs us on any given week. So should we talk? We always used to on these podcasts talk a lot about UK politics when there was a lot of it about during the referendum or not during the aftermath of the referendum and the craziness of politics then, but politics is still pretty crazy now. Let's talk about Boris and survival. Maggie, I'll kick off with you. Can he survive a fixed penalty notice, a fine? And or are these claims by Team Boris briefed anonymously that it doesn't really matter, it's only like a parking ticket? Is that sustainable?
I think if he's survived this far, he'll probably survive a fixed penalty, because in a sense that the crime has already been committed, and I think that's been accepted. What is astonishing now is that the party have not taken action against him, and I think the longer they leave it, the more likely he is to survive the whole thing. Actually, the moment has probably even gone. It was 2 weeks ago, so now I think people are slightly bored by it. And they might, if it's £10,000 that he has to pay, they'll just, I think most people, certainly if you're talking about general public, would just say, well, that's absolutely right. They got it wrong. They're going to be fined. It's the political reaction from his own MPs that's the important one and will decide whether he survives, won't it?
I just hate don't you just hate, though, the way in which, and this is, and I hate to say it's Trumpian, because Trump is his own distinct thing, but there are just echoes of the Trumpian approach. I had various conversations this week in London with people, some of them Tories who should know better, really, you'd think in terms of decency, who just try and get round the whole thing just by saying, well, it doesn't really matter, we knew it. But this, and that's what Boris does, is that he, there's so much chaos, and you get used to one development, and you to file that away, and you think, well, you know that, and that's old. But actually, let's just stand back from it for a moment. This is in December, there were no parties, and he had been assured that all the rules were broken. There's so much we've learned since then, which casts a lot of doubt on that. And you sometimes just have to stand back from the whole thing and think, well, look, the government which imposed the most draconian rules in peacetime, which spent hundreds of millions of pounds of our money on broadcasting stuff which was kind of Orwellian in tone, with warnings about what it meant to go outside, about being with more than one person, and about the consequences and the fines, and thousands of people were fined. But while that was going on, the person who runs the government was taking a very casual approach to the rules. I still find that original crossing of the line, I'm no longer outraged by it. I mean, you can't be outraged forever, but I just think that is a terrible transgression. I think it's really difficult to see how a prime minister survives that destruction of trust. Alistair, am I being too harsh?
No, yeah, I agree. Because we were told that, you know, popping around to have a coffee with someone was, you know, we were told to make an equivalence between things which ultimately were probably quite low risk and the language of death knell and killing. And
killing your granny.
You know, I remember Matt Hancock saying, don't kill your granny. What a thing to say to children and teenagers. I mean, and it just, you're right. Sort of, you have to have a sort of economy of outrage and you can't be angry forever. And there's, you know, people made mistakes and, but clearly the culture emanate, which is what was sort of quietly damning aspect of the Sue Gray report, is it in its own sort of quiet civil service way did sort of say they did it and the culture was fostered by really senior people in the British government, and that includes Boris, who leads the British government. So, but yeah, you're right, Maggie. It's a finely, I find it interesting. It's obviously a finely tuned judgment, because I think, and again, you'll be able to cast more light on this, but I imagine Tory MPs are saying, well, you know, come the next election, we're probably not going to, you know, the Tories are probably not going to get another massive majority, but they might get a majority of 20 or 30. Mm. And given that the SNP and the Lib Dems split the opposition and just probably won't even matter. And if Boris can get the Tories to do that, then maybe they should carry on with it. But
is the calculation.
Exactly. Labour seems to be getting their act together. You know, I just think that there's more to it, and there's stuff still to run. The Met hasn't, you know, that, I don't know, that it's going to look terrible when I imagine fines are doled out. You know, it's not going to look good.
I will be surprised. It's not impossible, and there is, as one of Boris's great supporters said to me, they're admitted that it's tough, but that there's a narrow path to survival, and he thought that he would walk that narrow path. I still think, and it's difficult to separate in these cases, isn't it, wish fulfillment or confirmation bias from trying to analyze the situation. It's difficult. None of us know. It depends on public reaction, polling, the response of Tory MPs, if fines happen. But
or another crisis, it will probably be something utterly different.
Well, I know, this is it, you know,
or borrowing more money, or, you know, but there's another Jennifer Curie waiting to come forward, you know.
It's only 4 weeks since the political discourse was dominated with the return to Westminster and the first PMQs by, oh, look, Boris has got a haircut and was pretty good at PMQs and has put all the unpleasantness behind him. So on everyone goes into the spring. And look what has happened in the intervening months. Look how much damage has been done. Talk to pollsters as well. Look at just how deep it has sunk into public opinion and people's attitudes in terms of favourability and what's coming out of focus groups. Now, people say, well, people trying to defend Boris said, well, the public are bored of it. But as we've discussed before, it is perfectly possible for it to be simultaneously true that people are bored of the media banging on about something, but that they also have formed a settled view that behaviour was wrong and that trust has been irretrievably broken. But you put your finger on it, Alistair, in terms of the analysis. The analysis is, look, how bad can it be? He survived previous terrible scrapes. You're just going to end up in a situation a bit like, you know, who's really going on now about the early pandemic? Human brain buries trauma, come out the other side, inflation will sort of tail off and bounce back from the pandemic. And then on your roll, Labour will take some seats off the Nationalists in Scotland, potentially. Tories will lose maybe 20 seats in the Red Wall. That's just the way of these things. And when you add it all up, the Tories will have a majority of 25, and Boris will then sail on until 2028, 2029. It's not completely impossible, but it just feels to me as though what's happened, Maggie, in terms of public opinion, it just feels done. I mean, I had conversations with people last night of a very politically engaged audience after a dinner. And when someone defended Boris at the dinner, no one even bothered to argue back. It was just an awkward silence. It wasn't, there was no rant. People weren't shouting saying he's got to go. It just feels done. And it's a question of how.
I would suggest another reason perhaps why the MPs haven't written their letters in sufficient numbers yet, and that is that there isn't an obvious candidate. I know you might say, well, actually they emerge, but I think the Tory party has sort of got to work out what it's about before maybe there is a leadership challenge. You know, Rishi missed his chance to try and be the low tax small state. Liz Truss has been sort of yapping on about it. Jeremy Hunt, Starry. There needs to be more interesting debate, I think, before you even get the seeds of some sort of contest. Yeah. And most of them, I mean, well, they're going along with the high spend, high tax, net zero for the moment, because they think it's more. But I think that could change.
Wouldn't you expect, as someone said to me last night, one of the contenders, like say Jeremy Hunt, wouldn't you expect him about now that he's been very, very quiet, and the rumour is a deal has been done with Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid to divide it up between themselves and be a triumvirate, and there is a question about whether these pacts ever hold. You know, Michael Howard's pact with William Hague didn't hold in 1997, and Hague changed his mind and ran and became leader. So sometimes these things just don't last. But even accounting for that, wouldn't you expect Jeremy Hunt about now to be making a series of policy speeches about the future of the country, about healthcare reform, about foreign policy, a range of things? Or maybe he's just worried about being interpreted about that being interpreted as starting a leadership campaign. However, I just think there is a hunger and an appetite for people to hear some new thinking and some ideas to move beyond this mess. So we'll return to this next week. Is there anything else we want to tackle? Maggie, you were going to mention gender neutral
toilets,
but that takes us onto the whole Adele question. And
it doesn't actually. I think it's sort of infrastructure issue. It seems infrastructure and good building. So it started off this week. Somebody complained that Costa coffee shops had male, female, and then they both had become gender neutral. I'm not sure if I got it the right way around. And that there was nowhere for just women to go. So, i.e. the men could go into both, but women. And then I noticed somebody else tweeted yesterday, was, I think a theatre in London, have become the same. Now, my issue with this is that if men really like going into nice, clean women's toilets, why don't we make the men's toilets much, much nicer? So rather than just nicking all the, cubicle type things, because most women don't want to have mixed toilets.
Interesting. I think it's a nice idea, like world peace, but I just don't see it ever happening. Just because they're full of men.
Yeah, okay, fine. But what I'm saying is, why are men trying to take ladies' loos?
I agree
with
you.
Why can't they sort out their own loos?
I agree with
you. No urinal has ever been invented that actually works.
Well, there we go.
As described. Try going to the loo in a urinal with the kilt on. It makes you never want to go to the loo standing up ever again. So.
I once got caught on the boat going from Newcastle to Gothenburg. I was quite young, actually, a young teenager, and the signs were pretty female and male, looked identical. I got caught in this massive men's loo where there are about 20 urinals. I had to sit and wait and keep looking underneath. I'm sure everyone had gone. It was a terrible
worst
experience.
Worst is in stadiums. The atmosphere in the male loos in stadiums is just something uniquely horrible about it. And listeners will be able to describe better than me what it is that is so horrible about them.
But, yeah, we'll move on from this. We'll move on from this in a second. But I continually astonished that women. Well, women are speaking out about this now. But just this erosion of women's spaces and just the inherent misogyny. I just find it staggering that there aren't. Kind of riots or marches to defend
ourselves to the women's loos.
I just mean that it's not just about that, but can more broadly. And then we were going to mention Adele, but there's not much to say really, is there? I mean, you said it all in a piece, Maggie, on Reaction this week.
And as I said, she has the bigger voice.
Yeah, though you did mention, what's the song she sings about setting fire to the rain?
Setting fire to the rain. It's
how do you do that? But what does it mean?
I don't know. It's just a brilliant line, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. I find it permanently baffling. How do you set fire to the rain? If any of you know the answer on how to set fire to the rain, then get in touch with us at Reaction. But this was the Reaction podcast that you were listening to. The Reaction podcast is back. It's really good to do this format again. Really enjoyed it. It's available as a podcast. It's also a few days later then available on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. So you can go also to YouTube there on the site and subscribe to that. You get my author interviews as well with leading authors. And if you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you've listened to this and you want to become a full member of Reaction, you get my weekly newsletter on politics. You get Maggie's column. You get all sorts of other great things from the Reaction team. Then go to the site and the details also are below. And we have our first event coming up with Justin Webb, sort of post-pandemic. Yeah, we didn't really talk about the end of the pandemic. I know people are then going to get in touch and say, what are you talking about? The pandemic isn't really over. But it does feel, we were all in London this week in the Reaction office meeting on Fleet Street, and it felt, didn't it, Alistair, like... So 2 years had passed and we'd lost 2 years, but we were returning to something like normal life.
Yes. Well, there's a fascinating Twitter thread by someone called Christina Pagel at UCL, who's a sort of involved with the Independent Sage group, Indie Sage, and talking about this idea, it's criticizing the idea that we can return to normal, that nothing will be the same and that's fine. And, you know, on the surface, yeah, fair enough. Obviously, you don't go back. Things don't revert to precisely the same. Behaviours will change. People will wear masks in public transport, you know, at certain times of the year, all that. But people who are sort of craving a kind of serendipity or kind of less emphasis on this kind of suite of measures which are always presumed to work in sync, such as ventilation, masks, testing, etc., etc., all of which in general don't affect nice middle class people but affect people most of the time who are in service and actually have a huge effect on schools. Like dropping the legal isolation thing does not actually affect most people because most people have been you know, well, you know, the work from home class just works from home for a bit, isolates. But it has been dreadful in schools. Anyone who has children, I know it's relatives who teach, it's literally that is the only thing it affects because that's where it can be enforced. It's really bad. So dropping that, I think, has been a perfectly sensible move, and people are very much attuned to COVID and test themselves and isolate when they're ill. And that's always been true of infectious disease that we've lived with for decades as part of a kind of long moral cultural evolution of what it means to live with diseases like respiratory viruses, which can be very nasty to people you love and people you don't know. And there's always been that thing, and that's not science based. It's a broader kind of morality.
There's so much in that. And I did think when I was read that thread that you described there, it was just kind of a reminder of, I suppose, being philosophically conservative, I would say this, but just the idea of that there's a normal to return to, a sort of fixed human state. Now, I mean, it's just what's happened to us in the pandemic. It's just yet again history showing us that, well, I would argue that progress, or the perfectibility, a state of utopia, a perfectible goal, all of that is impossible and a dangerous myth. But the change is constant. You know, so progress is maybe an illusion to one extent or another, but that change is something you adapt to. And this is just another historical change, which, relative to how badly the pandemic might have worked out in deaths, actually, a combination of vaccines, sophisticated, I mean, I'm talking about in the West primarily, West, sophisticated medical services compared to the 1920s. Death toll is horrendous, of course, and many people lost loved ones earlier than would otherwise have been the case. But it's an experience we've been through. It's a change. We'll adapt afterwards. We'll learn lessons about ventilation. But the idea that because this one thing happened, we can't have life back. I mean, there's another person who shall remain nameless, and who did get a bit of a sort of Twitter pile on. The hardliner on lockdown and COVID, who then tweeted a picture of themselves on the train saying, "First time on a train for 2 years." And it's like, well, just think how that sounds to the cleaner in Lewisham who has to get the train up to town to clean a government office to carry on getting paid throughout the pandemic. The working class people people of all classes who were delivery drivers and kept the country going and did all manner of jobs. Just the arrogance of that. First time on a train for 2 years. Look at me. Aren't I brave? Aren't I proud?
I missed that, Ian. Who was it? You must name.
No, I'm not going to encourage. No, because there was then a lot of.
Oh, was that okay?
Yeah, I thought it was a daft thing to tweet, but there was then a pile on from lots of other people from the other side, just being kind of serially unpleasant. But anyway, hopefully we're moving we're moving beyond that. But so that was a little sort of post-match, post-podcast discussion on COVID, and you've been listening to the Reaction podcast, also available to watch on YouTube. Until next time, thank you very much.